This is KGRB, AM Radio 90, and KBOB, FM Radio 98.3 in West Covina.
Hi, Garner Ted Armstrong. You know, every time we hear of a tragedy like that meteor collision over San Diego, we're tempted to ask, where was God? And why did God let it happen? So many millions of people have a religion of convenience, a religion of once in a while, just in case. We want there to be a God that is a protective God, a loving, gentle, kind, good God, and one who would protect us at all costs from some terrible happenstance like that, some unbelievable accident that is such a terrible tragedy. I couldn't help but speculate, as I was saying in the last program, about so many people who are going to be very quick to try to fix blame, to talk about pilot error, to blame the pilot of the small craft. Nearly always people tend to do this, or just to be very, frightened of flying at all. I know many people, and it's my only explanation for why the trains and the buses even survive in the United States, who are just plain scared half to death of flying in an airplane. They just don't want to fly. And yet, actually, statistics can prove that it is the safest method of travel, that you're actually safer. For all the sensational events that we hear, and when a large number of people are wiped out in a horrible, unfortunate accident like that, and the super sensationalism, because it's such a sick sight for such a mass death to occur all at once, we tend to see, because of the super sensationalization, a greater hazard, a greater risk in air travel than is actually inherent in air travel. But actually, you are safer in an aircraft, a commercial airliner, and even in a private airplane, you're safer than you are in a commercial airplane, apparently, than you would be in your own family automobile driving down the freeway, by far. You really are, and in terms of passenger miles, the number of hours, number of miles, however they translate it, that's been proved time and time again. And I wanted to talk about that again because there are many questions that need to be answered, and I have three specific suggestions, even at the risk of perhaps the wrath of some small craft owners, and I myself happen to be one. Well, I'll say my bank is, and they let me fly it. But having flown 65 types of aircraft, having approximately 4,000 hours now, and 11 types of jets, including about 9-plus years in a fanjet Falcon, I feel that I can speak with a little bit of experience in the field of aviation, and I think that I know a little bit about what I'm talking about, because I'm also an instrument-rated multi-pilot with a jet rating, and I think that when I see something like this happening, especially, it kind of gives me chills, because I happen to have been in the air, probably over New Mexico or West Texas, solid IFR, dodging thunderstorms and medium to heavy rain, and landed 5.5 hours later from nonstop from Phoenix, Arizona over to Tyler, Texas, with about 7.5 gallons per side in the tip tanks, and with all the paint gone off my radome on my 310Q model, a 1972 aircraft I had, the twin engine, and also on the spinner hubs, all of the paint was gone, and it wasn't too good shape on portions of the inboard leading edges, except I've got boots and hot tops, so it wasn't too bad because of the boots, of course, protected it, but it gave me a chill because I was in the air at that very time, and I didn't know what had happened until that night when I tuned in to network news, and then, of course, on television, we saw it the next morning on the Good Morning America show. So it is a hideous tragedy, and it's just sickening. You hate to hear of it, and people wonder why and how can it happen. I'd like to try to help explain that. The ILS approach that is used by commercial airliners is a very precision approach. It's a very clearly outlined one with not only a profile, but like a plat plan laid out on an approach plate. I frankly believe that it ought to be absolutely illegal for any small light aircraft, except on that ILS, except vectored into that exact flight path and under total control by final approach control and then the tower itself, to fly anywhere on or near that ILS profile. And I do not believe that airliners should ever deviate from it. That extra few minutes, 3 minutes, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, that it's going to take to complete the final segment of an IFR flight plan are just not worth cutting the corners if it involves risk, as it undoubtedly did in the San Diego incident. Now, let me explain. All big airports like that are equipped with a lot of ground aid navigational equipment. related with the airport itself is probably going to be at least one, and in some cases there will be two or even more of the VORs. But there will be one very close to it, which will be a part of the final published approach plan, the approach plate. That VOR sometimes is even lined up as a part of the approach with the runway. Sometimes the VOR is right on the field. More than likely in the San Diego case, it's over on Point Loma or somewhere else, as I seem to recall, and is not right on the field. So they will have an outer compass locator, which is a low-frequency homer, an omnidirectional one, which you can select. It will usually be a three-digit number, like 320, as it is in Tyler, Texas, and you turn your ADF to that. You tune for a signal. If you need to even swing your little loop antenna in some of the older models, you can do that. Make sure it's on ADF. You tune and you identify that station by an audio signal, and you will hear the Morse code. You can look on your chart if you don't know Morse code, and there it is. You can hear the beeps, and the co-pilot says tune and identified, and you got another little needle on a round instrument in your cockpit that points directly to, no matter which direction you turn the airplane, that needle will always faithfully point directly to that outer compass locator. Sometimes the outer compass locator and the outer marker, which is a little fan beacon, a fan-shaped beacon that goes straight up into the air and which will trigger a little blue light and an audio signal that goes beep, beep, beep when you fly over it. Sometimes they're both associated together, sometimes they're separate. It depends on the way the airport is set up. So the 727 should have been completing his instrument flight plan by being handed off from approach control to the tower and begin to descend according to that published approach over that outer marker. By this time, he would have his full gear down, probably have his spoilers and flaps out. He would be set up in the final approach speed. He would have established his exact sync rate that he wanted, probably about 1,000 in that aircraft or a little more feet per minute. And he would have been exactly on a prescribed speed. It would take him to the touchdown zone at precisely the right time. In this case, and I don't know the facts, I wasn't there, it was quite likely that because of the bright, blue, beautiful day, everyone chose to save a little bit of time. And so the aircraft that was just departing from Lindbergh Field, apparently, en route back to another airport nearby, or perhaps on a training flight, whatever he was doing, was turning to the left or flying straight out, I don't know. But the great big jetliner was turning inside and was apparently just told by the tower, and we'll wait and see what they have to say about that, to be cleared for a visual approach to that runway so he can cut inside the normal flight path from the outer compass locator and perhaps call the tower, establish on a base leg for runway, in this case probably 27 or whatever the runway heading is at Lindbergh in San Diego. It's hard to understand how a great big jetliner and a small aircraft like that can collide in midair when apparently there were the only two airplanes in the immediate vicinity and when apparently both pilots saw one another. Well, I'll guarantee you, unless you use instant judgment, when you see another aircraft, if it even looks like you're going to begin to come close to that airplane, you ought to take immediate evasive maneuvers, or even one moment hesitation at the closure speed that would have related. Even a little single-engine airplane could have been going 100, 115, 20 or so miles an hour. The big one would have been going probably 200-plus knots, nautical miles per hour, or about 240 or so statute miles per hour. That's a closure rate of about 350. How about driving an automobile down a road at 350 miles an hour? It would give you some kind of a sense of the rate of closure that might mean, and you can just take that off in terms of how many seconds or milliseconds it would take you to cover a few hundred yards. I don't know exactly what caused it. I was very happy to see one of the leading network commentators say that very likely it was the failure of the system, and not to be too quick to blame pilot error, to blame either the airline or the operator of the small aircraft. They all have a right to be there, small aircraft and the airlines. They all have a right to be up there in the air. The air belongs equally to us all, and there are far more people flying these days. The only question that everybody wants to see resolved is how to make the system work. How to keep the system as simple as it possibly can be, as safe, as effective, as non-fail as it possibly can be, as fail-safe, with all the backups necessary. I do believe it would be absolutely a tremendous thing if the companies could somehow be subsidized, I guess, by the government or something, because I, as a private aircraft plane owner, do begin to shudder as I start to think that another accident like this might bring the federal government to the point that they want to require that another very hideously expensive instrument would be placed in a cockpit, which would sound an alarm by automatically detecting another aircraft in the vicinity. Now, I wish, like everything, every cockpit from a little tri-pacer or a ragwing L3 or something right on up to a 747 had such an instrument. But I wish, like everything in our free enterprise system of competition, that such instruments didn't have to be produced by some of the avionics companies, because if the government were to come along and make a new regulation that by a certain date all aircraft must be equipped with these, the way they're now insisting, for example, in a TCA, which is a terminal control area, that all light aircraft must be equipped with an encoding altimeter, that is an altitude readout, so that your altimeter has another instrument attached to it, which will automatically hook up with your distance measuring equipment and your transponder. Basically, it's a part of the transponder equipment, so that on the scope in the terminal control area, your altitude, no matter what kind of an aircraft you're flying, will be read out automatically as you're descending. The man who is controlling your flight that sees a little blip that is your aircraft will see right beside it a number, and that tells him how high you are. Now, that proves to be a little expensive, but maybe not unreasonable. But some of these instruments can go up into the thousands and thousands of dollars for just one cockpit instrument. And when you look at that advertised in some of the magazines, and then you just maybe multiply that by the tens of thousands of private aircraft owners in the United States, and look at the billions of dollars of the price tag you're talking about, it mounts up in a hurry. I have three suggestions. I wish, like everything, they could be implemented, but I know it would be tremendously expensive. You know, during World War II, you can look out over the Western Desert, you see all those sort of chevron areas or the X's and the old abandoned airports all over the place, and they had training airports for student pilots all over California, up around Edwards and George, and out across Arizona and in other parts of the country. Why can't there be specially designated training airports? Airports with all of the full facilities that every major airport would have, including all of the sophisticated precision and non-precision approaches, a VORDME, an ADF, a PAR, an ILS, all of the approaches could be there. That's one suggestion, but you know, that's not going to be easy for anybody to implement, because it means millions of dollars in additional airport construction, it means rehabilitation, it means new equipment, it means fabulously expensive things such as new VORs and all of the various ILSs and the ADS, the middle markers and so on, the zones, the lights, the airport equipment that would be practical for new pilots to begin training and to have the experience of knowing what it means to be instrument rated. And that's my second recommendation. I honestly feel it doesn't make any sense at all for a person to be in the air unless he can be fully instrument rated. And I think because of our tremendous training schools, and like in the old days in the Navy, the link trainers that they had, and now they're so sophisticated, it's exactly like flying an airplane, except you can crash it and live through it. You can make mistakes in a trainer that you could never make. They call them a simulator, and they look exactly like the real thing, and I know I've spent hours in them, and they are available. It's too bad that they're as expensive in some cases as they are, but I would advocate that every pilot be required to be instrument rated before he is turned loose in an airplane by himself. He would be sharper, better off, prouder of himself, far better experienced and equipped. And I know it's bad news to say that for Sunday afternoon VFR flyers. I apologize. I'm talking about saving life, and I'm talking about if it were possible for him to do so without such fabulous expense. And that's the trouble. It costs so much money. And the third would be ground schools could be far more rigid, could have far better requirements, could require far more hours than actual ground training in that type of thing, like simulator training and actual instrument training prior to the time that a person ever really takes to the air. I think it would help a great deal if many, many pilots of small aircraft could have the same kind of training that the pilots of the airlines have. If they were all equally trained, equally as expert, I think everybody has a better chance. Now, I know that what I'm saying is to some people impractical. To me, it's very practical, but the only problem is it's too expensive, and that means it probably won't be done. But if you want this booklet on, Oh God, Where Were You When I Needed You, which helps explain accidents like this, was God involved, and why didn't God keep those planes separated? And what about the loved ones? What do they feel about it? How can they cope with the sudden, horrible loss of life in another mid-air collision? and write for this booklet, Oh God, Where Were You When I Needed You? To Garner Ted Armstrong, Box 2525, Tyler, Texas, 75710. At Garner Ted Armstrong, Box 2525, Tyler, Texas, 75710. Until next time, this is Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friend.
The program you have just heard does not necessarily reflect the views of radio stations, KGRB, KBOB, its personnel, management, nor ownership.